Okay.
Thank you.
So I have a couple of fairly limited purposes here today. I want to sort of try to help demystify the concept of traditional cultural property and also hit some of the high points. I'm not going to try to make you guys experts. You know, it takes a long time to get used to this. I think some of you know that, you know, before I came here, I worked for the Navajo Nation for 27 years. And everything I know about TCPs, basically, I learned there. When Tom King and Pat Parker were drafting the original version of Bulletin 38, I was already at Navajo, and Tom and Pat were sending me drafts, and we were passing stuff back and forth. And in fact, I was finishing my doctoral dissertation at the time, which actually dealt with what we now call TCPs, or certainly dealt with the concept. So there, at some point, I no longer knew what was theirs and what was mine. Nobody on my committee seemed to notice. Not that they would have, so that was okay. But I do have a lot of experience with this, you know, both positive and negative, I guess. And just some of the background on Navajo. One of the first things I did, or we did, when I went to work for Navajo was that we got some money together and went out to the chapters, and the chapters are the local units of government. There are 110 chapters on the Navajo Nation. It's 18 million acres. It's the size of West Virginia. And asked people to identify specific places that they wanted to see preserved. And, you know, we were hoping at the end of that we would get some idea of you know, how we could generalize that from the specific places that were identified. We went into that thinking, for example, that historic buildings, which were mostly federal buildings, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which, of course, the BIA, before it was the Bureau of Indian Affairs, was the Indian office in the Department of War. Their job was to subjugate the Indians and to keep them placid on reservations. We expected them to tell us that those buildings were monuments to colonialism, because that's what it was. We didn't expect them to identify archaeological sites, because archaeological sites are chindi in Navajo culture. And chindi means, let's call it dangerous, spiritually dangerous places. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a little bit more later. We expected them to talk a lot about what we think of as TCPs or sacred sites. We had an interview questionnaire so that, you know, people could just go down the list. I didn't do all the interviews. We interviewed several hundred people in the chapters. And, you know, we always asked about sacred places. That was the last question. If it hadn't come up sort of naturally in the interview, we asked about that. And we got consistent answers that I would paraphrase this way. I can't tell you about sacred places, but I can tell you about places stories are told about. So, you know, and one of the senior researchers on this project eventually wrote a book, and her book was entitled A Story Goes With It. And that was sort of my introduction to the concept that there is more to this than, well, this is a sacred place or it's not a sacred place, but that there's an actual historical element to it. I'm talking about, you know, the outcome of this was that roughly 40% of the places that they identified were archaeological sites. They wanted to see them preserved. Not because they were sources of data, which is what an archaeologist would say, what Nick or I would say, but because they were chindi. They were places sometimes where the dead resided. Sometimes they were places you could communicate with the gods. Occasionally, gods actually lived in them. And because they were chindi, they were also places where ceremonial material from healing ceremonies were placed. Because that's all, you know, what we think of, what you guys think of as sand paintings. Those are all part of healing ceremonies. They are ephemeral. They're disposed of afterwards because they contain part of the, you know, sort of the most elemental forces in the universe. They are placed there because the place is chindi. People aren't, you know, kids aren't going to go play there. And kids are told, you know, don't go there, don't play there. That's their, you know, as soon as they can walk, they're taught that. Amazingly, roughly 30% of the places that were identified were buildings, historic buildings. And the stories we were told about those buildings were very much what you would expect to hear from, you know, a person living in Denver. You know, this important person lived there. This important event occurred there. It's where I had my first job. It's where I went to school. That sort of stuff. So there were elements of this that were very much sort of what I would think of as conventionally historic. There were other elements that were, you know, that were very distinctly Navajo. And that was what we were trying to get at, was what was the distinctly Navajo. You know, historic preservation until quite recently was very much a, you know, let's preserve evidence of our colonialism. Chuck Hosmer, who wrote a two-volume, dull as dirt, history of historic preservation, identifies the very first effort to at historic preservation in the U.S. Was to preserve what was called the Old Indian House in Deerfield, Massachusetts. It occurred, I think, about 1815. And it was the last house in Deerfield that had survived an Indian massacre. Yeah, my Wampanoag friends say, well, you know, it wasn't really a massacre. We just got tired of these people pushing us around and taking our land. This is where we pushed back. But that wasn't what, I mean, ultimately failed, but that wasn't what the settlers were looking at there. And, you know, I think we can sort of, you know, it doesn't take very much thought to realize that that's sort of, you look at what has been preserved, what has been identified as preservation worthy for the most part is those sorts of things. Even when you talk about archaeological sites which may be of importance to natives, they're not being preserved because natives want them preserved. They're important to archaeologists, and it's the archaeological interest that is, you know, was driving that. So, many, many years ago, I gave a presentation at a National Forestry Conference, and I was on a panel, and the guy who spoke directly before me was an attorney for the Native American Rights Fund, trial attorney. And he talked for 20 minutes without a break, without a vocalized pause, without stumbling over a sentence or anything. It was truly a remarkable presentation. I don't have a written presentation. You can already hear me stumbling around. I stumble with written presentations. And so when I got up to follow him, he had a legal pad. I wanted to see what he had on his legal pad. In the middle of this legal pad was a single word. This guy had talked for 20 minutes nonstop without a flaw in his presentation based on one word. I guess trial attorneys are just a different breed of cat. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about some Navajo stuff later as this goes on, and I'm doing that both because, as I said, this is everything I learned about TCPs I learned there, but also there are things, you know, in any Native culture that it's okay to present, and other things that are confidential and should never be presented to the people who don't really have a desperate need to know it, who are non-members of the particular group. And since I worked there and worked with chanters on a daily basis, I know that for Navajo. I never fear that I'm about to say something that is violating some tribes, you know, protocols. So TCPs, you know, we're talking about Bulletin 38, and I think it is one of the critical things to bear in mind is that for the National Register purposes for Bulletin 38, it is about the National Register. So you have to be able to tie the place to the National Register. So that means the four criteria. It means integrity. You know, it doesn't mean you can't just say, I think that's really cool and it's important to us. That's not enough. You have to be able to tie it back. I do think that there are, there's a certain amount of flexibility there in how you apply the criteria. I think there has to be. You know, journalists will never miss an opportunity to tell you that, you know, the newspaper is the first draft of history, which is actually not true. The stories we tell ourselves and our family and our friends, that's the first draft of history. And I think particularly when you look at, say, for example, criterion B, association with important individuals, there's nothing in the National Register that says you have to prove that was a real person. So let me give you two examples. And I am giving you I'm doing these examples for secular purposes. They are about religious figures. I hope not to offend anybody, but I think they're apropos. Outside of the New Testament, there is almost no evidence that Jesus lived. And a historian would have to have an amazing amount of intestinal fortitude to argue this, would say that. There is one, there is a Jewish writer in writing about 70 AD who talks about this teacher who is causing a stir down by Jerusalem. That everybody believes Josephus was talking about Jesus. I have no reason to doubt that. But whether Jesus was real or not, you would be a fool to suggest that he didn't change world history. It's just, I'm not saying he didn't exist, but I'm saying you can't, based on four religious texts and one other text, which really doesn't talk about Jesus, talks about, if I remember right, can I remember? Yahshua. You cannot prove that Jesus. That's that simple. Nevertheless, historically significant, real or not. I would say Paul Bunyan, not real, not significant. You can't prove that he existed because he was a marketing ploy. But not important. Same token, the Buddha lived about 600 BC, and most scholars who I think are entitled to an opinion would say that Buddha was real. But it's really hard to prove that. And yet he, without a doubt, changed the culture of almost all of Asia, except for India, where he was born and raised, and did have an immediate, it did have an early impact. The fact that a person could be mythical, or could be somebody may not have been real, but doesn't change the fact that they had an effect. And particularly when you're talking about most TCPs, you're talking about oral traditions and oral history. It is very hard to prove from documents that this person was a real person. I mean, it's a little easier now. If you're working in the United States today, there are documents all over the place. But, if you're dealing with cultures that rely on oral tradition rather than writing, you have to go off of that. And, historians, they really grind their teeth when faced with that. Um, TCBs are not just about Native Americans or, you know, Native Hawaiians or what have you, Alaska Natives. There are all sorts of cultures in this country that are fairly traditional to some degree or another. The very first time I ever heard of the use of the concept was in a Section 106 context, where a dance ground by a Spanish pueblo in New Mexico, which was used every year for a dance, a traditional dance, as part of a fiesta, and was designated as a TCP, declared eligible. First time I ever heard about that. But, you know, so that, you know, is an indication that this is not just about natives. You know, I also will say that, you know, if you look at the, if you bother to take the time, I don't encourage you to do that, but if you want to look at what the Park Service is doing with their revisions of Bulletin 38, they go over, you know, they don't actually offer very many examples of TCPs. They say, well, here's this place, and it could have been eligible, you know, it was listed for whatever reason, but it could also have been considered a TCP. Now, part of that is, many of those places were listed long before the concept was available for use, and certainly not before it became a wide use in the community, in the preservation community. It's also a function of the way that there is no way in the Park Services, that their National Register database doesn't tag things. There's no way to tag them as TCPs, so it's impossible. I mean, you know, they got 1.5 million individual listings in the National Register. There's no way to go back and fill that information in. When I worked in Illinois, we got a property listed. It was a church in a Polish immigrant community in Chicago. It was unquestionably the ugliest building ever built by humans. It was truly hideous. But it was really important to the community. These Polish immigrants who came in the late 19th century to Chicago, mostly went to work as meat packers. They built this church, Catholic church. They built it themselves, and it looked for all the world like they built it out of, you know, spare packing crates that they'd stolen from a work site somewhere. But it was really important to them. I mean, it took us a year to work with them because it was so important to them. We worked with them in the Illinois SHPO's office, you know, and made the argument that this was significant to the community, to the history of the community, as this central place in their, you know, it was the central place in their community. It would never have been eligible as an architectural unless. Look at this amazing piece of vernacular architecture. Can you believe anybody thought this was a building? So, you know, it is a relatively new concept, although, you know, it is 30 years old. It's still evolving. One of the problems with trying to figure out how what the precedents are is that so much of this goes on in a Section 106 context. So, most of the time, the Park Service is never aware of it. This is an agreement reached between the federal agency and the State Historic Preservation Office. Yes, this place is eligible as a TCP, and you know, that's the basis for going forward through the compliance process. Occasionally, it will, as a result of the fact that the SHPO and the agency can't reach agreement. Goes to the keeper for a formal determination. So this is Mount Shasta, another very early example. This is a result of a dispute between the SHPO and the California SHPO. California SHPO thought it was eligible. The Park Service said, or not the Park Service, the Forest Service said it was not. The keeper, or not the keeper, but the keeper's staff said it was eligible. The Forest Service appealed that. At that time, the keeper was actually a deputy associate director. So it was not actually the person directly supervising. Its appeal went to the deputy, and the deputy associate director said, the keeper said, yes, indeed it is eligible, but not the whole mountain, just above a certain elevation, which, as it happened, was the area that was a wilderness area, which is, you know, development in a wilderness area is absolutely prohibited. There are no, you know, there are no options for any development there. But that's, yes, an interesting Solomonic decision, I guess. Another one. Oop, that's not what I wanted to do. Here we go. San Francisco Peaks. San Francisco Peaks, just outside of Flagstaff, Arizona. Important to at least 19 tribes that I'm aware of. The only real development up there on the mountains themselves is a ski lodge, which the Navajo tribe has been fighting since 1937. Other tribes have been fighting it subsequently. And at one point, because the lease needed to be renewed after 66, there was a 106 review. The tribes argued that it was a, you know, that it was eligible. This was before Bulletin 38. And I will say that when Bulletin 38 was sort of being shown around for the first time, that Pat Parker, who, as I say, is one of my oldest friends, was one of my oldest friends, is now deceased, saying, well, you know, here's a good example of a property of the CCP, forgetting that the keeper said it wasn't eligible. So there's a lot of confusion here. So, you know, they were, at one point, they were going through the process of, I think they're actually writing a National Register nomination for this now. I don't think it's actually gone as far as to the, gotten to the review board in Arizona yet. In my view, it's clearly eligible. I don't know what the fight is about. Actually, that's not true. I do know. But anyway. I do want to show you Pikes Peak. Am I in the right direction? Oops. I really screwed this up. Let's see. Okay. So, Pikes Peak is a National Historic Landmark. It was a waypoint on the way west. It's named for Zebulon Pike, who was an Army lieutenant who was doing a survey, a cadastral survey of the west at the time. But it was a waypoint on the trip to California for the 49ers. There is absolutely no, in terms of its historical significance, there is no material culture on Pikes Peak. None. It is simply it's a geological landmark, geographic landmark. I think that's an important point because we you know, people, particularly archaeologists, but not exclusively archaeologists, have frequently gotten into this, well, you know, but it's not been modified. There's no evidence of habitation. That's not the point. You know, if Pikes Peak can be a national landmark, I think, you know, any one of the mountains I've already shown you can be a national landmark, whether or not there's archaeology or anything else on them. The importance is its historical significance. I mean, by the same token, I mean, it would take an archaeologist to find it. There is nothing at Gettysburg except grassy fields. I think we'd all agree that's a significant place. I think its historical significance is unquestionable. What else do I want to say? So, which way is Mount Taylor? Mount Taylor? Nope, that's not the way. Nope. Mount Taylor. In New Mexico, by Grants, New Mexico, which is roughly halfway between Albuquerque and the western boundary of the state. It is something that it's managed by the Forest Service. And the Forest Service has been engaged with a number of Indian tribes, including Navajo, for a number of years on doing a nomination for this to list it in the National Register. The tribes were all doing this on a voluntary basis, so we did it when we had the time, and many tribes had way fewer resources. Many of the tribes interested in this had way fewer uses resources than Navajo had. And the Navajo view was that the mountain as a whole was a TCP. However, they all, the Navajo could also identify within on the mountain some particular archaeological sites were important, some springs that were important, and some places for gathering medicine that were important. The Hopi tribe, same thing, although I don't recall that they identified any archaeological sites, but they did have medicine gathering areas in the springs. It's the Southwest. Water is always important. It doesn't matter where you are. Acoma and Laguna and Zuni all had similar things. Now, interestingly, there was no overlap on the archaeological sites, although the springs were almost all, everybody shared the view on the springs. No overlap on the medicine gathering areas. I don't know what the status of this is. We ran out of time and resources before we finished it. And I mean, this is probably, each one of the tribes that was involved took a USGS quad map and drew a boundary. And, each one of the boundaries was different. And then the Forest Service drew a boundary which was larger than any of the tribes. And God knows what drove that decision. I mean, nothing we were going to complain about, but they never. This last when I left, they had not resolved that. So I think part of the problem with working with TCPs is that a lot of it is outside of the realm of the experts. It doesn't matter what the archaeologist thinks about Mount Taylor. It just doesn't. It's not of interest to, there are some archaeological sites of interest there, but it's important to the Navajo for a specific set of cultural reasons. I mean, and in Navajo tradition, there were these two mythological figures called the Monster Slayer Twins. They traveled through Navajo country killing monsters off, and the monsters had come out of the underworld with the Navajo people, and the Monster Slayer Twins were making the Earth surface world safe for humans to inhabit. One of the monsters was Mount Taylor. This is where they slayed the monster. Mount Taylor is surrounded by El Malpais, which is a lava field, and the lava is the monster's blood. So that entire area is significant because the Monster Slayer story, the Monster Slayer twins, are really important. They're the first humans. That's not true. Their mother was the first human. Sort of. Anyway, close enough. By the same token, when an architect looks at that and may say, what a wonderful, magnificent landscape, but it's not architecture. So if you're looking at trying to identify this as a significant historic place, you have to go to the experts who are the traditional members of the Indian tribes who are concerned about it. You have to rely on them. My experience with the Navajo, I never heard a Navajo lie about stuff like this. Because when you, these stories, The Navajo oral tradition is a, you know, it's an oral history of the Navajo. It's embedded in healing chants, and those chants have been, we know for a fact that they have not varied in over 150 years. Because the very first one of those, the Night Way, was written down in 1850 by an army officer. And you take that, what he recorded, and translate it into English today, it's exactly, I mean, it is verbatim the Night Way that a chanter does today. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, the Night Way and most other Navajo chants are healing magic. And magic works if you do it exactly the right way. If you say the right words in the right order with the right intonation, it will work. If you get any of that wrong, it won't work. You know, sort of like, I don't know if any of you had the lovely experience of learning computer programming, but it's the same sort of thing. It's like, if you put a comma where there should have been a semicolon, your program blows up, you know? Then you have to go to the error analyst who then looks at you like, how do they let you out on the street without a keeper? I had a lot of experience like that as a graduate student. Likewise for integrity. The question of integrity is for the traditional user, not for an archaeologist or an architect or even an ethnographer. Does it retain integrity? Does the traditional user think it does? You know, an example that, you know, I know of a cinder cone in north central Arizona was being mined for aggregate for a highway project. And it's a place that Navajo will go to, but it does appear in several of the chants. And, you know, Navajos told me, listen, even if it's gone, that place is significant. Even if the cinder's all gone, they're done mining, we will have to mention it in the chants. We will have to mention it in our prayers, because that's, you know, again, does that then become a comma rather than a semicolon? So, you know, part of the resistance to TCPs is this resistance. It's like, I spent 4 years in graduate school, and I spent God many more years writing my dissertation. I'm an expert, damn it, and you're taking my expertise away. But you just, you know, you have to acknowledge the fact that you know, this is an area of an expertise that you know, if you don't grow up in the culture, you're not going to get. You're just not. And even, you know, again, for the Navajo, one of the things I learned there was that, you know, they're within Navajo tradition, there are multiple layers. So there are things that it's okay for anybody to know. A Biligana like me, a white guy like me, that's fine. Nothing to that. Then there are things that it's really only appropriate for Navajo to know. Then there are things that only chanters and their apprentices can know. You know, a traditional Navajo might witness it, but they're not going to understand. It's the same way, you know, a devout Catholic may go to, you know, may witness what their priest is doing and not really understand the underlying theology. And then there are things where really only the most senior chanters can know. I mean, I had a chanter who worked for me. He had started his apprenticeship after 20 years in the police department. It took him 12 years before his mentor said he was, you know, he could conduct a ceremony on his own. He had assisted this guy for more than a decade. And, you know, he had eventually evolved into the chanter that other chanters went to be cured. Hatathli is Hatathli. And that's a real thing. And it occurs in every culture. People are sort of shocked. Well, why aren't they telling us this? Well, because it's none of your damn business. And in fact, they may not know the answer. It may take a specialist to know that answer. And you have to find those people and ask. And you have to trust them. For the Navajo, when you're, you know, the Navajo healing ceremonies involve calling to the gods, you know, the most elemental forces in the universe, and the chanter is dealing with them directly and personally at that moment. they're not going to get it wrong, because they're not just going to be consequences for the patient, but for themselves as well. So, you know, can I say that's always true? I mean, we do know, put my anthropologist hat on, we know that oral tradition in some cases, in the Navajo tradition, I think has been very conservative, very resistant to change. There are other cases where we know for a fact in, you know, the Bardic traditions in the Balkans, that a well-known story can morph in a matter of decades to the point where it's no longer recognizable as the original story, because those bards are amusement. They're there to entertain the audience. And so the bard is going to change it a little bit for every audience. And that's, you know, and then there's everything in between. And, you know, just as a historian looks at documents and applies, you know, critical thinking to it, you know, the anthropologist or ethnographer has to do the same. And really, I think the ethnographer's role in that is to say, you know, this makes sense in the context of what I know about this tradition. Because the real experts, you know, unless the anthropologist happens to be Navajo, the real tradition, you know, the real experts are in that. And that's it. That's all my wisdom. I'll wrap it up with one other thought. You know, TCPs are places that traditional cultures ascribe value to. And we sometimes, as professionals, lose sight of the fact that the places that are sort of conventionally historic are places that we ascribe value to. These places are not important because they have an inherent characteristic. They have value because, and it's like, look, the Prince Mahia building, speaking of ugly buildings, it's unquestionably, in my view, is, you know, something that's National Register eligible. But it's a hideous building. And we ascribe that, you know, within an architectural, you know, an architectural historical perspective. You know, archaeologists ascribe value to archaeological sites, and not all archaeological sites, and not even everything in the archaeological site. You know, so all of this stuff, you know, we tend to lose sight of the fact that we are, you know, we ascribe value to it, and that's why we want to see them preserved, or at least recognized for the potential of preservation. And, you know, I encourage you to bear that in mind. And as I said, the point of this is to demystify it. This is, people sort of stagger around this. They just, because it is a very alien concept for the most part. And we're dealing with things. Look, I lived and worked among the Navajo for 27 years, and there are things that I know I will never understand about Navajo, never. And this chanter who worked for me, you know, he'd come into my office and I'd ask him a question and he would give me an answer. And he'd walk away. And some days I would go, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then some days I was like, what the heck was that? And maybe weeks or months later I'd go, oh, I get it. And there's stuff that's still rattling around and I guess like, I don't know. So, and with that, I'll stop, you know, stop rambling and be willing to answer questions if you have any. Hope this helps, huh?
So is part of the difficulty then deciding whether you think the person who's presenting this is either somehow a cultural expert or has gotten information from a cultural expert?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that, I mean, to some extent that's always true. You know, and I mean, you know, and I've heard over and over again people ask that very question. Well, how do I know they're telling the truth? Well, you know what? Juries are asked to decide who's telling the truth every single day. And sometimes they're making decisions that will send people to jail forever. So, I mean, we all have, you know, and that doesn't mean they get it right, but we all have mechanisms for making those decisions. But absolutely, that's a critical part of it. Does this person make a representation, either an expert themselves, or basing it on what they have heard from experts. Yeah, no question that that's a critical part of it. But by the same token, I mean, you read a book that's written by a historian, and sometimes you look at it and go, this can't be right. You know, sometimes it's obvious that they have, you know, they've got a very strong political bias. That they're using this book to push forward. Sometimes it's just like, I mean, sometimes I've seen it. I mean, again with Navajo, I read what the ethnographers have written about Navajo, and I'm going, how long did you spend here? Hmm. You know, one of the most famous articles in linguistics, which proves that the Navajo just barely beat it into the Southwest before Coronado, was written by Edward Sapir, one of the biggest name in American linguistics. And Edward Sapir worked with one informant in Gallup, New Mexico, over the course of one summer. And he used, you know, he did his analysis of this word list that this informant provided him to conclude that the Navajo were very recent arrivals. And part of that was, well, the Navajo have like 7 different words for snow. It's the Southwest. It's the desert. It doesn't snow here, except Gallup's at 6,500 feet. It does snow there. So the winters on the Navajo reservation are brutal. You know, I lived through a snowstorm where in Flagstaff, which is on the western edge, they had 12 feet of snow. By the time it got to Gallup, it was down to 4 feet. And this was in 24 hours. So the Navajo know snow. But that was evidence that they've come from the boreal north and just barely got here. So they've retained all of these words. And oh yeah, and their word for corn is food of the enemy, which is not literal translation. It's the food of the other people. But then everybody, except in Peru, you know, adopted corn agriculture from the, you know, it moved up the spine of Latin America, finally made it to the Southwest. Even for the Hopi, who were famous corn agriculturists, it was not that, you know, they didn't domesticate grass, turn it into corn. So, you know, here's, I mean, honest to God, it's difficult to overstate the importance of Sapir as a linguist, as an anthropologist. And he wrote this piece, was like, what the? And it was taught to me as a graduate student as a prime example of anthropological theorizing. Look at what this guy did. Look at how he proved it. It's like, well, as a graduate student, I don't know anything about the Navajo. I got the Navajo and I'm going, wait, what? What's this about? So yeah, I mean, that's always true.
And then your example is people being in a jury and trying to decide if somebody's telling the truth, but you're basing that on a set of rules that have been provided to you, you know, compare them to this, whereas a cultural property, we don't necessarily know what those rules are because it's not our culture to judge it against.
I think in terms of evaluating the witnesses, it's not true, you know, because I'll give you an example. I was the foreman on a jury in Gallup. There was a guy, these two guys were on parole. They were found with a shotgun, which is a felony. They were going straight back to jail. No question about that. But they had also, it was also alleged that they were holding a couple of Navajos against their will. And, you know, the guy's defense was, well, it wasn't actually my shotgun. I'd loaned $50 to my cousin, and I was just holding that as collateral. Still in possession of a firearm, so it's not much of a defense, but it is. It's like, you know, as the former of the jury, I said, what do you guys think of this? I mean, I don't want to send this guy back to prison for criminal stupidity. And everybody said, oh, and he brought the cousin in. Cousin testimony, but yeah, I did this. And I said, what do you think of the cousin? Every person said, he's lying. And it wasn't one of these things where they sort of sat there and looked at the ceiling and ruminated. It was like, he's lying. It was instant response. So, I mean, I think we have that response to people. It gets a little harder when you're sort of crossing cultural contexts. But I do think, you know, when you're sort of evaluating what to recommend to the judge, that's a different thing. You get in detail. What's your finding? What's your recommendation? I mean, that's, at least in New Mexico, that's laid out. The two lawyers actually draft it and give it to the judge, and the judge approves it, and it's given to you. But it's given to the jury. So that's absolutely true. But when it comes to evaluating the testimony, that's done basically, I don't know, intuitively almost.
Well, I think, too, that there's room in the process, too, to get outside counsel or outside advice. That's why there's the process in the nomination review for public comment, right? And to seek individuals from that community to review the nomination and either reaffirm the findings within it or refute them. And I think that there is room for the review board, too, where if the evidence isn't laid out clearly with supporting sources, that is something that the review board can ask for, be expanded in a nomination for a TCP, just like any nomination. Like if somebody were to be trying to nominate a house that they're claiming was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright or a famous architect, but there was no reference or supporting evidence, that might be a comment that you would make. Like, where is the supporting evidence that this was designed by this person? So I think that there are certain standards across the board in reviewing nominations that can be applied to reviewing TCPs, as Alan's sort of saying. So.
I have a question. When you're looking at these examples, the example tomorrow, and you kind of mentioned this a little bit, question of like boundary.
Yeah.
How does that get defined?
Yeah, I mean boundary. I mean honestly, I think boundaries are always fraught, not just with TCPs, but with individual houses.
Sure.
And I frankly don't think that the Park Service's advice is that helpful there too, which was, you're supposed to draw the boundary, the smallest boundary that kind of is consistent with the character of the property. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, boundaries are, and it's especially problematic when you're talking about a landscape, and that's, I mean, these are all landscapes, certainly Mauna Kea is. Mm-hmm. There's no, I don't have a simple answer for it. I mean, I think the question is whether or not There's, and I think, frankly, on some levels, boundaries are always administrative. Mm-hmm. And so the question really comes down to, is there an does this give a clear justification that is administratively sound? Mm-hmm. I think you're aware there's a revised nomination, and I admit I have not looked at it. There's stuff to do. But, they do make the case that basically, Mauna Kea is the island.
Yeah.
In the nomination proper. And it's like, that's, I don't know, is that true or not? Culturally, they don't really make the case beyond sort of kind of a throwaway line. But yeah, so how do you narrow that down to something that makes administrative sense? That's, I don't have an answer for you. I do think it helps to think of it in those terms, though, as something that you're drawing for administrative purposes rather than because this is the actual edge of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you an archaeological example. We were working on an Indian Health Service water line on the Navajo Reservation between two towns. And it happened, I have never seen a density of archaeological sites like this. For essentially the entire valley, it was about 18 miles. There was no point where there was a real actual break in archaeological scatter. But the water line had to go in. I mean, it's drinking water for a community. And, you know, ultimately, we sat down and we drew boundaries around each of these sites where it's like, well, the density gets really low at this point. And then it was possible for the engineers to spaghetti noodle the water line through these sites. But, you know, as an archaeologist, I would have said, there's no way to distinguish these things. They were all virtually the same time period. They were all the same kinds of sites, at least based on the artifact scatters. And so there was a legitimate administrative purpose to drawing those boundaries. But if someone had just said, where does this begin and end? As an archaeologist, I would have put a big oval on the map saying, this is where the scatter gets so low it's no longer the thing anymore. You guys all enlightened?
I have a question.
Okay.
About boundaries. So eventually, like as a preservation professional, we're tasked with defining the boundaries of the TCP. How does one delineate boundary when there's differences in testimony? Because that in itself sort of goes against the idea that it's the traditional user that's supposed to be defining these TCPs.
Well, it's a little. I mean, this is particularly hard in Hawaii. I mean, for particularly tribes in the Southwest, there are people who are really recognized. And it's like Alfred Yazzie, who worked for me at the Hatafe Satafe. Nobody would have dared gainsay him. He was recognized. He was the man. But it's like anything else. As a friend of mine said, you get three Native Hawaiians, but I would say a Native Hawaiian friend of mine. Get three Native Hawaiians in a room and you get five opinions. That's the nature of the beast. People don't always agree. Even with the Bible in front of you, you can get, Lutherans do not agree with Catholics about a lot of stuff. And that's even true of Lutheran ministers and Catholic priests. So there's going to be variation in which ultimately you have to look at it and say, if you're just looking at written testimony, in essence, it's a little harder because when you're talking to somebody, you do get a sense. I mean, we all have that inherent sense of this person is being honest or this person's a snake. I wasn't pointing at you, Katie. Metaphorically, there's somebody in front of me. It's a little harder when you're doing that, and then you get into the question of what makes sense administratively. I mean, none of this, we're not dealing with nuclear physics here. There's very often no right answer. It's just a range of answers, and you make a decision based on what makes most sense. And sometimes what makes most sense in an administrative context.
There's a article I've always liked by Pat Parker, kind of talking about this, and the quote I always go back to is, she goes, many if not most traditional cultural properties were and are simply not meant to have lines drawn around them marking where they begin and where they end. And she doesn't really kind of answer the question. She says where we put a boundary on a TCP is somewhat arbitrary, and where it really matters is when you're defining your area of potential effect. So I think she acknowledges that the boundary thing is tricky and kind of kicks that can down the road a little bit and says you just sort of have to pick something arbitrary and then hope.
Well, I mean, I think boundaries are always arbitrary. I think that's the nature of the beast. Where's the boundary? What's the boundary of the state of Hawaii? The boundary of the state of Hawaii is 3 miles out from each of the islands. The archipelago is not the state. The state is the islands plus 3 miles, excluding Midway, which is not part of the state.
The only thing I would add to that, this whole conversation about interpretation, because boundary is one, so much of the nominations themselves are surrounding the idea of interpretation. Whether it's interpreting the boundaries interpreting the criteria. You're trying to interpret the rules of the nomination process in order to fit your historic resource within that framework. And so whatever, like Alan is saying, the emphasis on administration, that is your ultimate sort of bureaucratic goal, is to create some sort of tangible, you know, administrative record that can be utilized to understand this place and to add it to the written record. So it's too bureaucratic to think about a lot of these resources that way, but it's sort of like what you're forcing TCPs to do, is to fit into a framework that doesn't necessarily fit, or use the framework that exists so that you can include resources that were not considered when that framework was first written, to include them later on, if that makes sense. So even when you're looking at like National Register Criterion C, that's not architecture. That's what the category of architecture fits into, but it's like the built or designed environment. And so if you have a TCP in which a story is about an entity who built, say, a mountain, created that mountain, you could theoretically argue that that mountain fits into Criterion C because it was intentionally designed by an entity. So you can potentially argue that and see if it fits with the keeper's, you know, approval. But like, that's the kind of creative thinking that you, that individuals may need to do in order to try to make a TCP fit the administrative record.
So just to sort of wrap up that discussion in terms of what Pat said, is that, you know, in terms of that question about sacred places in our survey of Navajo, we often get, you know, that preference, the preface to the statement about, I can tell you about places that stories go with, was, it's, you know, it's wrong to think about as any one place is sacred or more sacred than any other. The entire Dinabakaya, which is the Navajo homeland, or sometimes the entire surface of the world, is sacred. But I can tell you about places that stories are told about. And those stories are, you know, in the context of Navajo, their oral tradition, their oral history. So they are, I mean, the concept I came up with when I was writing my dissertation was traditional history rather than traditional culture place. The, you know, Tom and Pat won because they were bureaucrats in the federal government, not me, and just worked for an Indian tribes. But I mean, I think that's, I mean, that provides context, and you're, you know, I mean, the boundary is an administrative, you know, the setting the boundary is an administrative action, and it's an administrative decision. And it, I don't, I mean, you make the most rational choice you can, but I don't think there's any, you know, there's no one answer. You know, we haven't had this discussion at the review board in a while, but it's like, well, this house is nominated. Is it the entire TMK that's the nomination? Or is it just the footprint of the house, or the footprint of the house plus the outlying, you know, features? I mean, boundaries, I don't care how you draw them, they're an issue. I mean, as a graduate student, one of the things I did as a research assistant was I was recording data off of the General Land Office surveys that were conducted in the early 18 teens, I guess. The survey, the cadastral survey of the state of Missouri, and they did it with, you know, not even a lempel. They did a farm with a, you know, a compass and a chain, a literal chain. The lengths of the chain were 3 inches long, and I forget how long the chain was. And they would, you know, stick a pin in the ground, and they would mark, you know, do marker trees if they could find them. To, you know, so that spot could be found again, and then they would run the chain out, and the, you know, they were doing the section, the township and range boundary surveys, and every once in a while you get to a point where, oops, you know what, the surface of the world, the earth is not flat, and we've got, you know, you can see it on the maps if you look closely where this township doesn't, you know, the corner of this township doesn't match the corner of that township. It's a little bit off because that's the way, I mean, that's the nature of the earth. But that was the basis of the survey. So, you know, you're always, we're always making it up. do the best you can.
Well, while we're thinking about boundaries and property and that sort of thing, I don't know if this is an AG question or not, but I know what it is on the National Register for the State Register. How does property owner consent work?
Okay, so there is no property owner consent requirement for the state. However, if a property owner objects, they are entitled to a contested case.
Okay.
Actually, Katie and I are going to talk to the deputy AG in a couple hours about this very question. When somebody requests a contested case, they're not necessarily entitled to one. People think, you know, we hear this, particularly the burial council, we hear it all the time. Well, I want to contest a case. Well, you don't actually have this may not be a contestable issue. This may not be something you're entitled to a contested case on. But the rules are clear that the property owner is entitled to a contested case if they request it.
And they would be evaluating whether it's register worthy. I mean, what?
With the contested case, yeah. That would be my view.
Okay.
What, you know, the fact that, you know, I as a property owner don't like it doesn't, you know, I don't see how that carries weight. Just as I don't know what you make of the 100+ emails you will see on the Mauna Kea testimony and saying, I think it's great, it should be listed. Well, yeah, well, what about the, you know, why? Mm-hmm. I would think that's it. We've never, at least in the 10 years I've been here, we've never had a contested case over nomination. So I don't know what the real issues would be. Maybe Cindy will enlighten us. But we're going to have to, I mean, there is a, so the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court has ruled that, you know, if somebody asks for a contested case before the decision is made, that you're supposed to stop. And their view is that because it's not just the review board, but all of the boards and commissions, hearings, meetings are so informal, with, you know, a couple exceptions. Most of them are very informal. Witnesses aren't sworn in. They're not crossing, you know, contesting parties don't have a right to cross-examine. There's no submission of evidence that's, you know, tested as part of that. So that as a consequence, their view is that the plaintiffs have been denied due process by relying on this completely informal process. And for many decisions, it seems counterintuitive that someone would have a right to a contested case before a decision has occurred, so they don't know what they're contesting, whether they even need to contest it. But the fact is that some affirmative decisions create an entitlement. So that person now has a property right in whatever that thing was. And so the plaintiff who opposed that action, they've been denied due process because that decision is made, and it's very difficult to unravel that after the fact. It would take a court order.
Thank you.
I expect Cindy's going to give Madam Chair an actual script to read before each presentation. One of the things that we will also be asking about is that I have been told that the golf course intends only to seek National Register listing. And it's not clear to me that because it's not a state decision. So the review board makes a recommendation on the National Register nomination. I review that recommendation and then certify it if I agree with it and send it to DC, where the keeper makes the decision. So there's no actual decision. I don't know. I honestly have no idea what
But with the National Register, it can't be put on the register unless all the property owners
They are prohibited from listing it under the property owner's objection. Although, you know, it's not simply a matter of I object. There's an actual process that they must comply with. And they have that right up until the actual moment when, you know, the keeper puts ink to paper and signs it as listing. So they don't have, so with a contested case here, they have to request it at the meeting. They have to follow it with a written request within 10 days. But, you know, that's not true with the Park Service. It's up until the moment the keeper signs the nomination. And this, what did you slide that?
Chandra, I was pointing out that we received testimony from the golf course, David, from their lawyer, David Key Leong, asking for a contested case hearing, or petitioning for a contested case hearing already for the golf course. So by the logic of the AG's office, if the petition comes in before the meeting, are we supposed to take that off the agenda?
We'll have to find that out.
Okay.
You know, what the rules say is requested at the hearing, and then followed with a written petition. And the process then would be, once we get the written petition, we have to respond. And actually, what I would do is I would draft something. I would give it to the AG. They'll review it, and, you know, they'll sign off on it, and then it will go to Katie for signature and go out with the decision, yes or no. But we will depart in advance.
So. Can I ask another question about TCPs? If practices change drastically, or there's a different group of people, if practices change either by change in technology or peoples or whatever, can you have two TCPs that are in essentially an overlapping boundary? So, like, we have, like, archaeological districts that maybe there was a prehistoric archaeological district, and then the military moved in, and now you've got a World War II district as well, and so it can be in the same space, we define it as two different districts. Can you do the same with a TCP?
Well, yeah, I would say yes. I don't see why not. And if you think about it,
I'm not sure if that practice is no longer, you know, if the practice changed, then can you still call it TCP today if it's not actively being?
Well, I mean, look, you know, this was, I mean, you know, we joked about this when I was a graduate student, and I imagine you probably heard it too. The only constant in culture is change. So these practices are always going to change, and, you know, even after they get written down, I mean, you know, church practices change. You know, they change slowly. I mean, and just as our language has been sort of, not necessarily codified, but it's been solidified by the fact that it's in writing now. So it's slowed things down, but it's still changed, it still evolves.
What if it's not like an evolution of a practice, but completely two different?
If it's completely two different traditional cultural practices, in overlapping areas, I don't see why there couldn't be multiple TCPs.
So the practices don't need to be carried out like today in order to be considered TCPs.
I'm not sure I followed the question.
Well, I mean, so. Say you've got an area that was once used for cultural practice, Native Hawaiians, for example, may still want to pursue it for their practices, but say the military's blocked them out of being able to do that.
Okay, so I would say, I mean, I think that's a special case, or at least I suspect it is. I think the fact that the government, you know, sometimes excludes people from areas is irrelevant. I think that's an absurd argument when agencies make it, and they do. I don't buy that at all. I mean, of course, it is likely to force a change in the cultural practice, because it can't be, whatever happened there has to happen some other place, and that may, you know, maybe it happen in a specific way at this place because of the features of the landscape there at that particular location. When you move it to a different location, it's no longer the same. And I will tell you that you know, again, with the Navajo example, mentioning a place in a ceremony is, from the Navajo perspective, is using it, even though that place may be hundreds of miles from where the ceremony is being conducted.
Tom King's got an interesting blog post where he complains about people in the Southeast that try to argue things aren't a TCP because of lack of continuity of practice when tribes have been relocated and, you know, forcibly removed from these places. And,
yeah, it's laughable. It would be laughable if it didn't have real-world consequences, I guess. But, yeah, absolutely true. You know, and the same thing is true, you know, I think after the Second World War, you know, certainly it happened in Navajo. I expect it happened to other tribes where, you know, people removed from the reservation and settled in cities. The woman who was my deputy director for a while at Navajo, she'd been raised in Oakland. Her dad was, you know, I came back from the Navy. He was a shipbuilder in the Navy, and they moved into Oakland to build ships at the, you know, the shipyard there. And they, you know, she was born in Oakland. She didn't come to the reservation until she was in junior high school. The family moved back. And that was not a huge practice, but I mean, it'd occur. And anything, you know, if that person happened to be traditional, what they did in Oakland or whatever other city it was is going to be different than what they would have done. I mean, they're not going to a Canalda or a, you know, a Nightway or what have you. It's not possible anymore. I think actually she was Native American church, but that's, I don't know what her dad was. Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I didn't see it come in, but Cindy said she was going to send us a link.
Yeah,
to the team.
Yeah, and then I saw that it was canceled, so I don't know. I saw something for 3:30, and then there was a canceled thing.
Are we done with the training?
We're done.